Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, July 16th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcasts at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at FranStorchND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. My health update, I'm doing pretty good. The last thing that happened to me since I have been on the show is I wound up getting a cortisone shot. So that was exciting. Then the worst thing about the cortisone shot was the anticipation. The experience of getting the cortisone shot was very good. So I think I talked about that last week. Since I did that, I went and saw Dr. Malozzi, who is the spinal surgeon that directed me to get the cortisone shot. So I had a conversation with him. And where I am with my back is I am in a wait and see position. So they want to see how I do. I don't have the radicular pain. I don't have pain that starts from my back, goes through my butt, goes down my leg. That's gone. But what I still have is a lot of tightness and numbness on the outside of my left thigh. That's still very much present. It concerns me because I don't know if the shot obviously didn't get to that, or it didn't get to that yet. And I was also told that the biggest benefits of the shot could take as much as 2 weeks or longer. So I may not have completely benefited from the shot yet. They did tell me that I could go ahead and try to ride my bike. And I had also read online that you should wait to do strenuous activity for at least a week after you get the injection. So I definitely did that. The injection happened on a Thursday, and I'm recording this on a Saturday. And so it's been 9 days since the injection. So I went on a little bike ride today. I only went 7.5 miles, and it was so great to be back on my bike. I remembered how to ride my bike, and I climbed some little hills, a quick route that's very close to my house. And there are some light hills that I had to climb, and I was able to do it. I wasn't huffing and puffing. I still had the fitness to do what I needed to do. I don't think I would have ridden 20 miles or more, but I rode sub 10 miles. And tomorrow I will probably ride something like 9 miles. So I'm, just very short rides on easy terrain until I get I have my fitness back. I want to get my cardiovascular fitness back. I think one of the things that's happening is I tend to get PACs, premature atrial contractions, and they have kicked up since I had the cortisone shot. So I get that from when my Lyme is kicked up, and I also get it when I'm anxious, and I also get, and I'm getting more since I had the cortisone shot. So I take motherwort to help keep that at bay. I take magnesium, taking a lot of things, coenzyme Q10. I'm taking a lot of things that help to keep them calm. Keeping me calm helps them to not happen as much. I'm also hoping that if I get back to doing cardio exercise, my heart will beat more evenly, and because I have a higher resting pulse right now since I haven't been doing cardio exercise. And so I'm hoping that that will calm down. And if it doesn't, I'm going to have to consult a cardiologist probably. And that's concerning to me because the first step that they do is they give you medications, and the medications they give you slow your heart rate down and make you dizzy and make it so it's harder to exercise. So I'm nervous about that. So I'm going to try to do as much as I can naturally, taking plenty of motherwort. Motherwort tincture I tolerate quite nicely. I can take it throughout the day. I have a lot of it, and I can continue to do that. But I am concerned that this leg still has a lot of tightness and numbness, and I have to get fit again. So I'm going to probably ride my bike about 3 times a week for a little while until I can manage to do more. So the cortisone shot definitely helped. It definitely helped. I don't have that awful, horrible femoral nerve pain. And I also had a very good experience at UConn. So that was very good. So far, so good. And I saw patients in person this week. I only saw virtual patients if they wanted to be virtual. Next week, I'm planning to see patients in person, and I did okay with that. So that's exciting. Moving right along. And Ron is getting better and better every single day, and he's being more active to the point where he does too much, and then he gets really sore, and he has to rest, and he still sleeps a lot. He's got another month to wear that cervical collar. Poor guy. So, you know, we do what we can for him. He doesn't need as much one-on-one care, although I do put Epsom salt lotion on his back, and that's a good thing to do because it's got magnesium in it. He doesn't like magnesium oil, which is, magnesium oil is not really oil. It's not an oil. It's when you dissolve magnesium in water, it becomes oily, but it's not technically an oil. But he doesn't like the feel of that. So we give him the lotion. He doesn't mind. He's used to lotion. And the lotion comes in lavender, and it comes in coconut. It comes in, we don't have the eucalyptus spearmint, but we have the coconut and the lavender. So he has options of either of those. So that's very nice. So I'll put that on his back when he wants it. And then he's doing a lot of ice. So he got a great big ice pack that he can strap to his back, or he can just lie on it. And it's the size of his entire posterior torso. So that's great. So, and he does that a few times a day whenever he feels like he needs it. And it really makes him feel better. So that's great. So if you have inflammation in your back or your knee or any part, icing can be really helpful. It definitely makes things feel better. It can help to reduce inflammation. It can help to reduce excessive circulation that's causing you pain in local spots. So knees, backs. I haven't been doing ice, and I could stand to do more ice, and I think I will. I do put salves on my leg and my back that are cooling, that they have menthol and camphor in them, so they have a cooling effect on me. So I do like to use those. What I haven't done yet is I haven't gone in water, and I do have a friend who said I could use his pool. Haven't done that. I haven't been in the ocean, and I haven't been in Bicentennial Pond, and I haven't been to the Mansfield Community Center. So at some point, I will probably get myself into water, at the very least go to my friend's house and get in his pool, because that's probably the easiest thing to do. You know, that's, I don't have to worry about getting into the community center and figuring out where I'm going to do what in the communal pool there. So anyway, I'm very grateful to my friend for letting me use his pool. So that's what's going on with us. And so now let's move on to some things that are interesting. So the day that I had my shot, I think I told you I had gone to a cafe, and I asked them if I could have an ube matcha latte, and they said sure, and then they proceeded to give me a taro matcha latte. They didn't, then the young woman there thought that taro and ube were the same thing, and they are not. So here, let's tell you what the difference between taro and ube are. The reason people confuse them is because they're this rich, incredible purple color, and they have these terrific anthocyanins, these antioxidants that are really good for your body. So here's what the differences between ube and taro are. So purple yams, or ube, are nutritious. They're versatile, and they're starchy root vegetables, and they have lots of antioxidants that can help reduce blood pressure and blood sugar levels. It's the Latin name for ube is Dioscorea alata. Now, Dioscorea is the genus of all yams. All yams and sweet potatoes are Dioscorea. Or at least yams. I'm not sure about sweet potatoes, but that's a good question. Let's find out. What is the genus of sweet potatoes? So the genus of sweet potato,
according to Kew
Gardens. Ooh, guess what? Sweet potatoes are Ipomoea. They are not the same thing. So Dioscorea is the genus of yams, and sweet potatoes are Ipomoea. I did not know that. So ube is a yam. It's a purple yam because it's Dioscorea alata. And it's referred to as the purple yam, the ube, the violet yam, or the water yam. And it's a tuberous root vegetable, comes from Southeast Asia, and it's often confused with taro. So it is an indigenous staple of the Philippines, but now it's a foodie thing. You can get it everywhere. My niece-in-law is of Filipina descent, and when we went to their wedding, my nephew and niece, when they got married, they had a cake, and the cake had ube in it, so it, I guess, was a purple cake. So purple yams have grayish-brown skins, like any sweet potato or yam, but the flesh is this beautiful dark purple. And their flesh becomes soft like a potato when you cook them. And they have a sweet, nutty flavor, and you can use them in a lot of dishes, from sweet to savory. And they're loaded with vitamins and minerals and antioxidants, which benefit your health. So so the ube is very nutritious. It has a lot of carbs and potassium and vitamin C. One ube has just 140 calories, 27 grams of carbs, a little bit of protein and fat, 4 grams of fiber, a tiny bit of sodium, a nice bit of potassium, a little calcium, iron, vitamin C, and A. They are rich in powerful plant compounds and antioxidants, including anthocyanins, which give them that terrific purple hue. The studies show that anthocyanins may help to reduce blood pressure and inflammation and protect against cancer and type 2 diabetes. Purple yams are also rich in vitamin C, which help keep your cells healthy, boost your iron absorption, and protect your DNA from damage. They have lots of antioxidants, mostly the anthocyanins and vitamin C. Antioxidants protect your cells from damage caused by from harmful molecules called free radicals. Free radical damage is linked to a lot of chronic conditions like cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and neurodegenerative disorders. Purple yams are a great source of vitamin C, which is a potent antioxidant in your body. And if you consume more vitamin C, you can increase your antioxidant levels like 35%, which will protect you against oxidative cell damage. Anthocyanins in purple yams are a type of polyphenol antioxidant. When you regularly eat polyphenol-rich fruits and vegetables, it can lower risks of several kinds of cancers. There's promising research that the two anthocyanins in purple yams, which is cyanidin and peonidin, I guess because it might be in peonies too, I'm guessing, and they can reduce the growth of certain kinds of cancers, including colon cancer. There was a 45% reduction in one study in tumors in animals treated with dietary cyanidin, while another study found that it slowed the growth of human cancer cells in a test tube. And lung cancer, there was a test tube study that showed that peonidin slowed the growth of lung cancer cells. And then prostate cancer, this was a test tube study that showed that cyanidin reduced the number of human prostate cancer cells. These studies did use concentrated amounts of cyanidin and peonidin, so it's unlikely you would reap the same benefits from eating whole purple yams. Over time, if you eat lots of brightly colored fruits and vegetables, it does overall reduce your risk of many kinds of cancers. So anthocyanins help to reduce blood sugar, so the ube can do that too. The flavonoids in purple yams have been shown to help lower blood sugar in those with type 2 diabetes. When you have obesity and inflammation caused by oxidative stress, those increase your risk of insulin resistance and poor blood sugar control, and also type 2 diabetes. Insulin resistance is when your cells don't respond properly to insulin, which is responsible for maintaining your blood sugar control. There was a test tube study that observed that flavonoid-rich purple yam extracts reduced oxidative stress and insulin resistance by protecting insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. There was a study in 20 rats that found that administering them higher amounts of purple yam extract lowered their appetite, encouraged weight loss, and improved blood sugar control. There was another study that reported that a purple yam supplement reduced the rate of blood sugar absorption in rats with elevated levels, resulting in improved blood sugar control. The purple yams have a low glycemic index, so the glycemic index ranges from 0 to 100, and it's a ranking of how fast sugars are absorbed into your bloodstream for that food. And purple yams have a glycemic index of 24, which is at the low end of the spectrum. So the carbs are broken down into the sugars slowly, so it gives you a slow, steady release of energy instead of a blood sugar spike. The purple yams may help to lower blood pressure. High blood pressure is a major risk factor for heart attack and stroke. Purple yams may have blood pressure lowering effects. Research believe this is likely due to their antioxidants content. There was a test tube study that found that purple yams contain antioxidants that may help lower blood pressure in a way that's similar to the common blood pressure lowering medications called angiotensin converting enzymes. That's all the prills, like lisinopril, benazepril, and enalapril. Another test tube study showed that antioxidants in purple yams could prevent the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. That's what an ACE inhibitor does as well. And so those are compounds that are responsible for elevated blood pressure. When these results are promising, they were observed in a lab, and you have to do more research before saying for sure that they're going to be beneficial in humans. It may improve symptoms of asthma. Asthma is a chronic inflammatory disease of the airways. There's research that suggests a high dietary intake of antioxidants like vitamins A and C are associated with a reduced risk of asthma. There was a study of there were 40 studies of and a review of those that found that the occurrence of asthma in adults was associated with a low vitamin A intake. Those with asthma were only meeting about 50% of the daily recommended intake of vitamin A on average. In addition, the incidence of asthma increased by 12% in those who had low dietary vitamin C intake. Purple yams are a good source of antioxidants and vitamins A and C, which help you reach your daily intake for these vitamins. So the ube helps to promote your gut health. And they can how they do that is because they're full of resistant starch. And that's a type of carb that's resistant to digestion. One test tube study showed that the resistant starch from purple yams increased the number of bifidobacteria, which is a beneficial gut bacteria in a simulated large bowel environment. And those bacteria play a vital role in your gut health and aid the breakdown of complex carbs and fiber. So when you eat resistant starch, you're going to get more bifidobacteria, which is that's going to help your carb digestion, and it could help with insulin sensitivity and fat loss. They may even help reduce your risk of certain conditions like colorectal cancer, that's the bifidobacteria, and inflammatory bowel disease and irritable bowel syndrome. They also protect healthy, they produce healthy fatty acids and B vitamins. One study in mice found that purple yams had anti-inflammatory effects and decreased symptoms of colitis. However, more research is needed to know if eating those has anti-inflammatory effects in people with colitis. Purple yams are very versatile. I bought purple yam powder, and boy, is it purple. If you put a little of that purple yam, I made a latte. I made an almond milk latte with purple yam and matcha, and it turned this incredibly dark purple. If I don't put the matcha in, then it's this really almost pinkish deep purple. And then if I put the green in, then it gives it, you know, it takes out that sort of pinkish hue and it makes it a little more earthy purple. But it's incredibly purple. You feel like you're drinking antioxidants. It's really incredible. More and more cafes are carrying ube, and you can get ube in your coffee or ube in your matcha. So ask for it. If your favorite cafe doesn't have it, keep asking for it. Say, would you please get some? You know, so, and then maybe they'll start carrying it. Some cafes do carry taro, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So ubes can be boiled, mashed, fried, baked. They're used in a lot of dishes in place of other starchy vegetables and soups and stews and stir fries. And in the Philippines, purple yams are made into flour, which is used in a lot of desserts. The other thing I wanted to say is, when I put that ube into the latte, I didn't need to add any sweetener. The ube itself is sweet. So you may find that you don't need any kind of sweetener if you add ube powder to your coffee or to your green tea. So it's very interesting. So in the Philippines, they process it into a powder, and they use it in rice, candy, cakes, desserts, jams. So what's purple yam versus taro root? Now, taro root is an entirely different genus. So as we said, purple yams, the yam genus, all yams are Dioscorea. So wild yam that we use as a progesteronic in natural medicine, it helps to boost progesterone. It stimulates progesterone receptors. It isn't actually progesterone. The diastein in Dioscorea, in wild yam, that is definitely a yam. The diastein stimulates as progesterone receptors, but it does not exactly mimic progesterone. It isn't progesterone. So taro root is Colocasia esculenta, and it's native to Southeast Asia as well. It's often called the potato of the tropics, so it's going to be similar. It varies in color from white to gray to lavender and has a mildly sweet taste. Purple yams and taro root look similar, which is why they get confused. Nonetheless, when stripped of their skins, they are different colors. Taro is grown from the tropical taro plant and is not one of the 600 types of yams. It's not a yam. It's a different genus. Purple yams are incredibly nutritious and starchy root vegetables. The powerful antioxidants may help reduce your blood pressure and blood sugar levels. They're tasty and versatile with a vibrant color, making them an exciting ingredient and can be used in a variety of sweet and savory dishes. So this didn't tell us a whole lot about taro, which I would be interested in. So I think what I will do is they told us what the difference was, but they didn't tell us why taro is good for you and how to compare it. So I will do that next week. Okay, so the next thing, we're going to go back to talking about feisty menopause, about giving you some menopause stuff about menopause and nutrition. So here is more information about whether menopausal women should cut carbohydrates. This is a great article. It's written by Celine Yeager, who we had on the show a few years back. And she called in and we had her on the show. So she writes for Women's Health and other, she's writing for this Feisty Menopause, which might be her website, and it's a blog and there's a podcast. So she wrote this article about whether menopausal women should cut carbs. I'm going to go with no, but let's see what she says. High carb, low carb, no carb. Women in menopause get a whole lot of mixed messages. Let's see. Let's cut through the confusion. If you look at certain corners of the internet long enough, you'll become convinced that carbs are the devil incarnate. Active menopausal women perform best when they're well-fueled, and that includes carbohydrates, which are a primary fuel source for exercise, especially for higher intensity efforts. And they're the preferred fuel source for our brain. Carbs improve performance, delay fatigue, and are good for mood and mental health. If you eliminate or restrict them, you're going to miss out on important fiber, antioxidants, anti-inflammatories, and phytonutrients that you need as an active woman. So Hillary Wright, who is a registered dietitian and who wrote the pre-diabetes diet plan, said on one of her podcasts, you're probably going to be tired all the time and maybe more depressed if you just avoid carbs or go to low carbohydrate. Carb restriction elevates your stress levels, I think I've said this before, and increases your risk of iron deficiency and anemia. This is true even among men. A study published in Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise found that race walkers who followed a low-carb, high-fat diet for 6 days had higher inflammatory and hepcidin, which is an inflammatory compound, responses after exercise than they did when they were eating a higher-carb diet. That's a problem. Hepcidin makes it harder to absorb iron after exercise. Women need to be especially cautious here. Hepcidin already stays elevated up to 24 hours post-exercise in postmenopausal women. The higher it is and the longer it remains elevated, the more problematic it is for iron absorption. I take iron every day because I feel like my ferritin runs a little bit low. I like to see ferritin at least 60, and mine tends to run around that or maybe a little lower than that. So I take a low dose of iron, I take ferrous bisglycinate. That's what I'm taking, and it doesn't give me constipation. It's easy to absorb, doesn't bother my stomach. I'm very happy with it. So, if you cut out carbs, it could be detrimental to your bone health. Also, when the athletes who did very low carbohydrate had unfavorable immune markers when they trained on the low carbohydrate, high fat diet. They were also more than 7 minutes slower on a 25K laboratory race walk test than they had been on a high-carb diet. So carbs give you fuel and they help you to perform better. If you cut out carbs, it can be detrimental to your bone health. And you want to keep your bones because you're more likely to lose bone mass the older you get. So you shouldn't be messing with that. There was a 2019 study that investigated how diet and exercise impacted bone health markers in elite and endurance athletes after spending 3.5 weeks on a low-carb, high-fat diet, and then again after they started eating a higher-carb diet. Researchers found that markers of bone resorption increased and markers of bone formation decreased, and those markers didn't completely bounce back after the athletes resumed their higher carb intake. They also concluded long-term effects of such alterations remain unknown, but may be detrimental to bone mineral density and bone strength, with major consequences to health and performance. Cutting out carbs doesn't make any more sense today than cutting out fat did in the 90s. There's a reason that there are 3 macronutrients. We need them all. So macronutrients would be your protein, your fat, and your carbohydrate. Generally speaking, moderately active women need 3 grams of carbs per kilogram body weight. So if I weigh 70 kilograms, whoa, so 70 kilograms, that means 70 times 3, I need 210 grams of carbs. That's a lot. So that's if I'm moderately active, and I wonder if I'm moderately active or lightly active. So I want to be getting around 210, probably 200-ish, because I guess when I get back on the bike more regularly, I will be back to moderately or even more active. So, of course, you can't get away with talking about menopausal women and exercise without talking about Stacey Sims. Stacey Sims said that. She said 3 grams of carbs per kilogram body weight. She created Menopause for Athletes and also wrote the book Next Level, which I got for Christmas this year. But aren't carbs bad for menopausal women? Active, performance-minded women still need carbs. We just do better metabolically if we dress them up and time them well. That's because the hormonal and metabolic changes that happen during this time can make us become more carbohydrate sensitive and insulin resistant. There was a study of 1,002 women, which was published as a preprint in The Lancet, so it hadn't been peer-reviewed at the time of this article, and they found that postmenopausal women had higher fasting glucose, hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of your average blood sugar levels and the percentage of red blood cells that have been damaged by elevated blood sugar. Postmenopausal women had higher fasting glucose and A1C and inflammation than premenopausal women. This was true even if they were the same age. They also consumed more sugar and had poorer sleep, and their blood sugar and insulin responses were higher after eating than their premenopausal peers. So just from being peri and postmenopausal, you have a more difficulty with insulin sensitivity. The researchers concluded that diet and gut microbiome changes could help resolve some of the issues. So that when you eat, what you may eat may partially reduce the unfavorable health impacts of menopause, either directly by reducing inflammation and blood sugar or indirectly by altering the microbiome to a more favorable composition. So the senior author of that study was Sarah Berry. She's at King's College in London. And so the modifications, here they are. They look similarly to the general dietary advice that's good for everyone. Emphasize whole foods and go easy on super refined carbohydrates. So white flour, white bread, white pasta, white rice, sweets. You may want to cut back on those, but do eat healthy carbohydrates. Carbohydrates that come from nature that human beings have been eating forever, whole fruits and vegetables and whole grains are quality foods. So if you eat your oats, your quinoa, your brown rice, if you eat, name the fruit or vegetable, you can eat any of them. They're all going to have fiber and they're going to have nutrients that help you to absorb the carbohydrates. And they all have prebiotics that help you to make good gut flora. When you take a carbohydrate, whole food, and you process it into something else, you end up stripping a lot of the health benefits, and so then they become carbs for fun. You know, like Skittles and red velvet cake and chocolate and cakes from the cafe. You know, croissants, things like that. Carbohydrates that come from nature that human beings have been eating forever, like whole fruits and vegetables and whole grains, are quality foods. When you take a carbohydrate, whole food, and you process it into something else, you strip out those nutrients. Postmenopausal women can still eat carbs that are just for fun. You don't have to never eat your red velvet cake or your tiramisu or whatever your thing is. Fun carbs are great for birthday parties and can also be quite useful before and during exercise. When you're on mile 97 of a 140-mile ride, that bag of Sour Patch Kids may save the day. It's okay at that point. But when you're not doing that kind of exercise, you might want to focus more on fruits and vegetables and your ube and your taro and your sweet potato. So at Feisty Menopause, they want to provide guidance for working with your changing physiology during and beyond the menopause transition. When it comes to carbs, here's some strategies that can help offset the increased carbohydrate sensitivity that can happen during this time. Eat the carbs around your workouts. Eat your carbs, especially the breads and pastas, around your training. That has the dual benefit of fueling your workout so you can hit the high intensities and helping your body manage its blood sugar response. When you're physically active, you're producing proteins called glucose transporters inside your cells. They partner with insulin to regulate your blood sugar. So when you exercise, it makes it easier to manage your blood sugar in the hours after you eat. It's the most natural thing you can do to make insulin more able to unlock your cells. Pair your carbs with protein and or fat. When you eat carbs with other macronutrients, it helps calm the glycemic response. In fact, one of the things we try to tell people who are not necessarily physically active, is if you're going to eat carbohydrates, eat your fill of fiber, protein, and fat first, and then have carbohydrates after. So if you want to have that roll with dinner, try to eat it after you've already had some protein and vegetables in your meal. That will help you avoid carb stacking. Many women will layer three or four carbs on top of each other at a sitting, and there's no protein to slow digestion, so you spike and you crash. When you add protein with your carbs at every meal, especially breakfast, you'll have more steady energy. Aim for at least 25 grams of fiber in a day. That's hard to do, but not impossible. If you have oats with chia seeds or flax seeds, and you throw nuts and seeds in there, if you snack on nuts and seeds, if you have some whole grains, if you have fruits and vegetables throughout the day, you'll hit that goal. If you have a big salad for dinner, or a big stir fry, or roasted vegetables, you'll probably hit that 25 grams of fiber. Fiber literally feeds your gut health by nourishing those essential microbes. If you eat at least 25 grams of fiber a day, you'll hit that marker. When you're an athlete, you probably need more. Fueling gut microbes was a study that was published in a couple years ago. It recommends that athletes aim to eat 14 grams of fiber per every 1,000 calories, which would mean 28 grams for active women on most days. Fiber prevents those blood sugar spikes. Finally, eating more fiber means eating more plant-based foods, which research shows can dramatically improve menopause symptoms. Just remember that because fiber slows digestion, you don't want to load up right before a hard workout or a run. You don't want to eat a ton of fiber right before a workout, because it's too... That's when you want to eat somewhat simpler carbohydrates, if you're going to eat carbohydrates. Because big load of fiber, you're not going to digest it and you're not going to feel good on your workout. Heed your hunger. If you restrict food, that will lead to binging. That's because gram per gram, your brain burns twice the carbs of your muscles. You can't expect to have great control over your impulses when you're starving. If you're restricting carbs all day and ignoring your hunger, your brain's going to make more demands. So there you go. So the idea is, if you are peri- or postmenopausal and a woman, it's a good idea to continue to eat carbs. Now, I know there are some people who go on ketogenic diets. My experience with my patients is people don't tend to stay on ketogenic diets. I do have a patient who's doing one right now and is doing fantastically well on it, and blessings to him. And if somebody comes in and they're like, I am so happy, I feel wonderful, I'm doing this diet, I'm not going to say anything about that. I'm not going to tell them to stop. If they find out over time that they really can't do it, then that's up to them. But somebody comes in, I'm on this great diet, I'm losing weight, I feel fantastic, I have terrific energy, I can exercise, I'm not going to stop them from doing it. I do find that men tend to do better with intermittent fasting, and we know that's what has been studied, that intermittent fasting is not really encouraged for women. The studies on intermittent fasting were done on young men, and when you're a woman and you do intermittent fasting, you're having too long of a period where you're not eating. Now, if your intermittent fasting means that you're not eating for 12 hours and you are eating for 12 hours, you know, you're doing equal levels during the day, that's fine. But if you're getting into the 14 versus 10 or even the 16 versus 8, and you're having a large part of the day where you're not eating, that can be hard on your body. And what happens when women fast is that our leptin levels go down and our ghrelin levels go up. And that effect is more pronounced in women than in men. So ghrelin is the hunger hormone. It's the hormone that kicks out and tells you that you're hungry, makes your stomach growl. And then leptin is the hormone that makes you feel satiety. It makes you feel like you've eaten and that you don't need to eat more. So your leptin levels tend to go down if you starve yourself, and your body will often feel like intermittent fasting. If you're a woman and you do intermittent fasting, if it's not the 12 to 12 hour intermittent fast, your body will feel like you're starving, and you will lower your leptin levels, and it will be harder to stay with what you're doing until one day you binge. I want to say a shout out to Bill, who's listening or watching on Facebook. Hi there. Carbohydrates, my understanding is carbohydrates are good for you, but not, you know, necessarily M&Ms, unless you're having a few M&Ms as part of your workout. But for the vast majority of the day, you want to be looking at fruits and vegetables and starchy tubers. So you're looking at cassava and your ube and your wild yam and potatoes and whole grains. And those are the kinds of things you want to be looking at eating. Oats, things like that. And lots of fruits and vegetables. So, all right. So let's see what Stacy Sims has to say. And this is more of the same. Women need to exercise and eat differently than men, and here's how. So this is an interview. This is taken from an interview of Stacy Sims. So reproductive health is an issue, has been an issue for a number of years. President Biden previously signed an order to improve women's health research. And the directive was notable because it aimed to integrate women's health across federal agencies and drive new research. So for many centuries, medical research have exclusively studied men, downplaying or ignoring sex differences and extrapolating findings to women, which doesn't work. However, women are not physiologically the same as men, marked most plainly with the onset of menstruation of female puberty and having two X chromosomes. And so have been given incomplete, poor, and harmful medical advice. The longstanding lack of female-based research stemming from sex and gender bias spurred Dr. Stacy Sims, who's an exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist. She lives in New Zealand, in Maunganui, New Zealand. Who knew? Because she's American, but I guess she lives in New Zealand. So she's devoted her career to determining how women should be eating and exercising for optimal health. If you work with our physiology, knowing that women are women and men are men, knowing that women are not small men. Women are not small men. How many times I've heard that from her? I've heard that from Celine Yeager, and I have heard that from my buddy Marissa Axel, who focuses on mostly peri and postmenopausal women who are cyclists. Women are not small men. We are different. And we have different physiology and different nutritional needs, different levels of insulin sensitivity, and different ways that we need to eat. So cardiac arrest is a good example. It was known in 2007 that women are nearly twice as likely to die from heart attacks as men, and that they report many more symptoms associated with acute coronary symptoms this is an NIH study. That year, they still recommended against differentiating heart attack symptoms between men and women, which makes no sense. Even today, women remain broadly underrepresented in medical literature. There was a study in 2022 in Women's Health that was reported about. Misogynistic attitudes remain as well, and while the U.S. National Institutes of Health in 2016 implemented a policy that required researchers to consider sex as a variable in biomedical research, the results were still mixed. There was a number of studies, including women, that noticeably increased after the policy debuted, and there was a 29 analysis where they analyzed large volumes of data that showed that the majority of more than 700 medical studies failed to analyze the resulting data by sex, which limited the usefulness. Stacy Sims authored the science-based book Roar, and that details sex-based differences in exercise and nutrition at different life stages. And she shared her thoughts with CNN, who I got this article from. By the way, if you're going to start a new exercise program, talk to your doctor. Stop if you experience pain. So how can it be possible that women are still medically understudied in recent years? Stacy Sims thinks it's nuts. Historically, when you think about who developed science and research, women were pushed out right at the start. Men were like, oh, women are less beings than us. We have smaller brains. Even Darwin said that women weren't as smart because we have smaller brains. So when you think about scientific method and how it all started, who were the people in the room? It was all men. No one really questioned the lack of women being studied. They just assumed women were smaller versions of men, so whatever works for men works for women. And tradition is really hard to change. Here's a photo of Stacy Sims. One thing about during the pandemic, Stacy Sims did, she appreciated that it did cause researchers to sit up and say, wow, we really need to look at sex differences. COVID-19 was more severe in men, but side effects of the vaccine were more prominent in women. Long COVID has hit women more severely and has affected their brains more than men. That's why we're seeing all these sex-specific stuff come out that's really good science instead of just generalized. So what are some basic things that women should be doing when it comes to exercise? So what's the best exercise for you? You hear me saying this on the show all the time. The best exercise for you is the one you'll do. So Stacy says that too. Any movement is good, but it's more important that women put in strength or resistance training. It's more for brain health. If you look at resistance training and the neural pathways it creates, we're seeing it really does help attenuate dementia and Alzheimer's, and there's a sex difference there as well. Historically, though, women haven't been directed into doing resistance training, but across the board, from young to old, we should be doing strength training. Does strength training have other impacts as women approach menopause? Of course. When your hormones start changing between ages 40 and 50, it has a massive effect on your body composition. We start losing muscle and putting on more body fat, but if we have that lean mass from strength training, it really helps calm down that rate of change. Strength training also helps protect our bones and helps us keep our balance and proprioception, the awareness of where our body is in space. We don't see those kinds of changes in men until they're in their 50s to 70s. So when we say resistance training, that can be training with weights. It can be training with other non-weight apparatus. So on a board or bands or, stretchy things that you put on the door, or doing body weight exercises. If you do vinyasa yoga or power yoga, or, yoga moves that where you have to hold up your body weight, that's resistance training. You're going to build your muscle mass if you do that. So you find a muscle mass that you like and that works for you. You can take classes and all of those, whether you're using weights or you're doing body weight training, you're going to build muscle mass and you're going to enhance your proprioception, which is going to enhance your balance. Proprioception is they are receptors in your muscles, in your skeletal muscles, that help you to know where you are in space. So the more muscle mass you have, the more proprioceptors you have. So the better balance you have if you do resistance training. And it can be with light weights, it can be with heavy weights. You can go to the gym and get a personal trainer. You can get programs online. You can, if you don't want to go to the gym, you can look at YouTube or other free online services that will help you to find exercises that you can do. You can go to a physical therapist. You can go to a personal trainer who can come to your house, or you can go to their space, wherever that is. But figure out some kind of resistance training that you are willing to do, whatever that is. And it doesn't even have to be for a long time. If you did 7 to 10 minutes of somewhat intense resistance training 3 or 4 times a week, that's enough. That's plenty. You don't have to spend 40 minutes at a gym. You can spend 10 minutes at home and it will be helpful for you. So exercises between the sexes, what's the difference when it comes to cardiovascular stuff? Men can get away with everything, is what Stacy says. Women already have the capability of going long and slow, so we don't need to do that kind of exercise. Our bodies are already there. What we do need is high-intensity work, those true high-intensity intervals of 30 seconds or 1 minute. These help women raise our metabolic rate. It helps reduce visceral, that's deep belly fat, and more importantly, it helps our gut microbiome diverse and helps helps your cardiovascular health. So when we look at all the research in high intensity versus moderate intensity versus low intensity workouts, we really need to push the emphasis for that high intensity workout plus resistance training. So do women recover from exercises as in the same way as men do? Right after exercise, there's a blood pressure difference. Women will experience vasodilation, so their blood will go to the periphery, the outside of your body, whereas men will have vasoconstriction, which means all their blood comes back to their heart and can be pumped a lot faster for a quicker recovery. So women tend to get lightheaded and feel a little dizzy after a hard session because all their blood is pooling out in our extremities. Drinking something cold right after exercise helps bring that blood back centrally, reduces metabolites, and starts the reparation process. So that's really interesting. Women are going to tend to feel a bit lightheaded after a hard workout, whether it's cardio or, a long bike ride or a brisk walk, or, if you're doing resistance training. And the first thing you should do is get some cold liquid, and preferably water, probably with some electrolytes in it. So that's what I have in front of me now. It's not so cold because the water has been sitting here for a bit. So it's not so cold right now. And I finished my workout at I don't know, a few hours ago. And I did have some cold water after that. And then I had a protein shake, which was cold. I put that in the fridge. So drinking something cold will make you less lightheaded. I wonder if that's true in general. If you tend to have autonomic issues, that drinking something cold will help you feel a little less lightheaded. That's why I like to have cold water with electrolytes in it on hand all the time. Sometimes I feel like I want my water without electrolytes just for difference, but most of the time there's at least a little bit of electrolyte in it. And when I'm on the bike, there's always electrolytes in the water. I will sometimes carry one bottle with electrolytes and one bottle without, but most of the time when I'm sipping off the water bottle while I'm on the bike, it's got electrolytes in it. And I have electrolytes for every day that are much lower in salt. They have more potassium, they have a little bamboo extract, and they have trace minerals in it and a good bit of potassium, but not so much sodium. Like only a little scoop of this electrolyte powder has 160 milligrams of sodium, which is not very much at all. So my sport electrolytes have a lot more sodium in it. And you want that because you want to be able to absorb that water quickly. When I was outside today, this is the first time I did cardio since April. And I was probably not used to being outside in the heat. It wasn't super hot, but it was hotter than I realized. And of course, it got hotter the longer I was out. I mean, I wasn't out for very long. I was out for a total of 39 minutes. But when I went out, it was in the low 70s. And when I got back, it was in the mid 70s. And it's kind of humid today. The feels like is a few degrees warmer than the actual temperature right now. And I think we're going to get mid 80s today. And the feels like is high 80s because it's humid out there. And so I'm not used to that because I haven't been. It's kind of harsh because I'm getting back into cardio exercise at the hottest point of the year. So I have to be really careful. I have to go early in the morning and I can't go for long. And I have to gradually increase my timing so that I get used to the, get used to sweating and getting used to acclimate to the hot weather. So, and then the big thing is cold water, right when you get home, have some cold water, preferably with electrolytes, as soon as you get back, and you'll get that water in faster and you won't be as lightheaded. So there's a big conversation around protein intake, and the recommended allowance for women is really low. It's based on cadaver work on 70 to 80 year old men. That makes no sense. So protein is important for both sexes. We need to emphasize it more for women. And as we age, because we become more anabolically resistant to exercise and protein intake, which means our bodies don't respond as well to exercise and protein intake to build muscle. So it takes more protein post-exercise and higher loads or more volume of resistance training to get muscle protein synthesis. Generally, women should have 1 to 1.1 grams of protein per pound of body weight a day. That is a lot. Oh my goodness. So I'm rocking the 150s right now. So 150 grams of protein, that is a lot of protein. If you're doing strength training, try to have 15 grams of protein before a session and 30 to 35 grams after, which will help with your strength and facilitating reparation. If you're doing cardio, 15 grams of protein with 30 grams of carbs before, the carbs will help bring your blood sugar up because your bodies go through blood sugar quickly. Women do that. But afterward when you need the protein, 30 to 35 grams or 40 grams for perimenopausal and early postmenopausal. 40 grams of protein, that is a lot of protein. There's been a lot publicized recently about the benefits of intermittent fasting, training in zone 2, long and slow, and other fads. Are these equally beneficial to men and women? I'm going to go with Stacy's going to say no. So let's see what she says. Most of the trends out there are great for men, but it's a different story for women. My voice is always, let's show why we're seeing for the general population. What we're seeing for the general population is not appropriate for women, but also what is appropriate for women. Because no one's used to pausing and saying, all right, I heard this. But what was the population it was studied on? If it was studied on men, it might not be great for me as a woman. Well, what's appropriate for me? It's too many steps. So So that's a great issue. So what we're saying here is you need to eat a fair bit of carbohydrate and you need to eat a lot of protein. And the older you get, the more protein you need. And she's like a gram to 1.1 grams of protein per body weight. So if you weigh 150 pounds, that's 150 grams. If you weigh 170 pounds, that's 170 grams. That is a lot of protein. I don't know if I could get that in. I admit that I don't think I'm doing that. And that if I my little app that I have on my phone, when it says, hey, you reached your protein goal, it's usually sub 100. And really, I need to be at very least, at the very least, I need to be eating 100 grams of protein a day. And that's what I tend to tell my patients. I'm not sure I'm going to tell them 1 to 1.1 grams per body weight. That's probably for very active athletes. But for your average person, you could probably get away with about 100 grams and a little bit more the older that you get. And that, in part, may be why women have so much trouble taking weight off when they're perimenopausal, because they're focusing on carbohydrates, they're not eating enough calories, and they're not focusing on protein. And if they would eat more protein, whether or not they went low carb, that protein would help them to maintain their body fat better, so, and be at a weight that made them happier. So it was very interesting. All right, so let's see. Let's go back here. All right, so good old Stacy Sims. Now, one of the things that I keep saying is that there's not any one supplement that really can help with fat loss, and yet I am asked all the time. So I did pick out a few that might be helpful, and I'll tell you what they are, and you can try them if you want to. So first, let's look at conjugated linoleic acid. So can conjugated linoleic acid help you lose weight? Conjugated linoleic acid, abbreviated as CLA, may help you lose some weight, but there are more effective ways to lose and burn fat. Instead, it's better to eat the CLA foods in your diet. When you're trying to lose weight, you're often advised to eat less and move more, which doesn't necessarily work, but it's often ineffective on its own and people don't reach their goals. So people turn to supplements. One of them is CLA, conjugated linoleic acid, and it's found mostly in meat and dairy products. Research shows it's effective for fat loss in animals, but evidence in human is not so promising. And so what it is, it's naturally produced by grazing animals. So animals with hooves, with split hooves, who chew their cud. So you're going to get CLA from red meat. Well, we'll see what it says. You're going to... cows and other pastured ruminants, like goats and deer, have a unique enzyme in their digestive system that converts omega-6 fatty acids in green plants to CLA, conjugated linoleic acid. It's then stored in the animal's muscle tissues and in milk. So if you eat grass-fed and finished, or if you eat milk, consume milk products from grass-fed and finished cattle, there's going to be more CLA than if the animal has not been grass-fed and finished. It's stored in the animal's muscle tissue and milk. There are many forms of it, but the two important ones are C9, T11, Cis9, Trans11, and T10, C12, Trans10, Cis12. So C9, T11 is the most abundant in foods, whereas T10, C12 is the one often found in supplements and associated with weight loss. T10, C12 is also in foods, but in smaller amounts. As the term trans implies, this fatty acid is technically a trans fat, but the trans fats found naturally in meat and dairy products are much different than the industrial processed artificial trans fat that are found in baked goods and in fast foods. Industrial produced trans fats are strongly linked to heart disease, while naturally produced trans fats may be good for you. So CLA is not an essential fatty acid, so you don't need to obtain it from your diet for optimal health. Nevertheless, many people take CLA supplements for their purported fat-burning effects. The studies show, see, I have taken it and I haven't noticed much, and I've had patients take it and they haven't noticed very much, and this backs that up. Many high-quality studies have analyzed the effects of CLA on fat loss, and its fat-burning potential is much stronger in animals than it is in humans. It does reduce body fat in animals. Research shows that CLA reduces body fat in animals by increasing the amounts of specific enzymes and proteins involved in fat breakdown. There was a study in mice that found that supplementing with CLA for 6 weeks reduced body fat by 70% compared to placebo. CLA has also prevented fat gain in animals in test tube studies. There was a study in pigs that showed that it decreased fat growth in a dose-dependent manner. This means that increased doses resulted in decreased gains in body fat. These significant findings in animals prompted research to test it in humans, but the studies didn't find great stuff in humans. The research shows that in humans that CLA has only a modest weight loss benefit. There was a review of 18 high-quality human studies that looked at the effects of CLA supplementation on weight loss. Those who supplemented with 3.2 grams per day lost an average of 0.11 pounds, which is half a kilogram, a week, compared to a placebo. So that's not much at all. While these findings were considered significant, it translates to less than half a pound per month. So you're better off doing other things that are more effective and wasting your money on CLA. Several other studies have looked at the effects of CLA on weight loss in humans. One review of these studies evaluated its long-term effectiveness on fat loss in overweight and obese participants, concluded that taking 2.4 to 6 grams a day, which is a lot and is going to be expensive, for 6 to 12 months reduced body fat by 2.93 pounds compared to placebos. Again, not to me, that's not worth it. Additional studies have found that CLA is mixed but no real-world benefits on fat loss, even combined with exercise. Current research suggests that CLA has minimal effects on weight loss in both the short and long term, in addition to potential side effects. There could be some harmful issues with it. Some studies have found them to have no adverse effects, but there's some other studies that found that there was an increase in levels of C-reactive protein, which is an inflammatory marker. On the one hand, inflammation is important for fighting off harmful pathogens or initiating tissue repair on a scrape or cut. On the other hand, chronic inflammation is linked to diseases like cancer and heart disease. What's more, other meta-analysis found that supplementing with CLA was associated with an increase in liver enzymes, suggesting inflammation or liver damage. CLA from natural dietary sources is not associated with these effects. So if you get your CLA from cheese, from grass-fed and finished cattle, sheep, goats. So you can get cheese that has, if it's from grass-fed animals, then it's going to have more CLA in it. And then if it's grass-fed and finished meat from these animals, whether it's goat, sheep, or venison, or cattle, cows, steers, whatever, you're going to get more CLA. So CLA taken in supplement form has different health effects than CLA from your diet. So until more research is safely available, you shouldn't really take it for a long time. I would say, quite honestly, don't bother. That if you want to increase the CLA in your diet, the best place to get it is from grass-fed and finished meats and dairy from grass-fed and finished animals. While you may not reap the same fat loss benefits, you get it from natural sources. And those natural sources, if you're eating them to the exclusion of refined carbohydrates, that's going to help you lose weight. So that's all I have time for today. And we'll look at some more fat loss supplements next week. And we'll also talk about what exactly is taro, because I thought that that article would compare ube to taro head to head, but it really didn't. It just said, here's what ube is, and no, it's not taro. So you have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.